Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to the Waypoint UK podcast. My name is Mike Diver, senior editor of Waypoint, and I'm joined today by a very special guest, I think a very special guest, and hopefully you will too over the next hour or so. I'm joined by Ian Livingstone.
Hello.
Hello. Ian Livingstone, CBE.
That's right.
And various other letters and numbers and names and achievements, accomplishments. I've mentioned to a few people who were asking me, you know, when's the next podcast, who's on it? I was like, oh, bit of a British gaming legend. You must get that bandied around a lot.
I guess because I've been in the games industry 41 years.
Is that just because if you hang around long enough?
Somebody's heard of you.
Hang around long enough, you're a legend.
Yeah, I guess so.
But I mean, I'm really pleased that you're in today because, I mean, for a few reasons, really. One, Fighting Fantasy, which we'll get to soon enough, which is a book series that you started with Steve Jackson so many years ago. But also because 2016 is the 20th anniversary of Tomb Raider. So I want to talk a little bit about your old relationship with that. But at the very start of things, as far as I know it, in terms of your history, was kind of Games Workshop and starting that. So I just wanted to start there and talk a bit about, because it's fascinating to me to see how, like, Dungeons and Dragons, for instance, is enjoying this massive resurgence, and tabletop gaming in general. And there you were in a little shop in Shepherd's Bush, right? I think that area, importing this stuff originally.
Yeah, well, it was actually started off in our flat in Shepherd's Bush. I was sharing the flat with two old school friends, John Peake and Steve Jackson, and we were pretty penniless, had pretty boring jobs, and we played lots of board games. And thought, wouldn't it be great if we could turn our hobby of playing games into some sort of business about the games industry? So we decided to publish a newsletter called Owl and Weasel, and we sent it out to everybody we knew in games. And one of the recipients was Gary Gygax, the inventor of Dungeons and Dragons, who lived in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. He wrote to us and said, love your magazine. Here's this new game I've just invented. And it didn't look much. White box, pretty average drawing on the front. And yet it opened up your imagination like no other game had ever done before and probably never will again. And we played it. Steve and I became immediately fascinated and obsessed with D&D. And John didn't like the idea. And but because here was a radical game, one you role playing as heroes and wizards going on these fantastic journeys of the mind, killing monsters and finding treasure. And so we ordered 6 copies because that's all the money we had. And on the back of that amazing order, Gary gave us a 3-year exclusive distribution agreement for the whole of Europe.
Which, I mean, this is the thing, you know. So what year is that? That's late 70s, is it?
That was 1975.
So mid-70s.
February 75.
It's incredible to think now, you know, with Dungeons & Dragons being everything it became and the sheer scale of it now, it all started over here with 6 copies that you bought into your flat.
And we sold them mail order through Owl & Weasel, which was like an instant print thing. And then people started to hear about this game, this role-playing game, and... But no one knew how to get hold of it. I mean, there was obviously no internet. Mobile phones hadn't been invented. Not many game shops. But the word of mouth spread. And I used to see people. We were on the 3rd floor. And I used to see people on the street looking for this Games Workshop. Expect to find a shop. You have to open the window. You want a workshop? Up here, mate.
You want a little kind of pulley system out the window. You know, put the money in the basket.
Exactly. And we had no... obviously, mobile phones didn't exist. Mm. We didn't have a phone in our apartment. But there's a public payphone on the ground floor and it always ring. And our landlord, who enjoyed a drink on a Friday, would always get to the phone first. We'd zoom down the stairs, always too late. You'd hear him, hello, you want Games Workshop, do you? can go to hell. He used to hang up on him. And we realised the power of public relations.
I was going to say, some disgruntled early customers there. Despondent and not being able to get their holds on, their hands on, you know, what became
this phenomenal, like you say, just voyage of the mind.
Yeah. So we ended up having to leave our flat in Shepherd's Bush. We'd gone over to Gen Con in 1976, met Gary and signed up all these fledgling games companies. And because we'd been kicked out of the flat, we had nowhere to live. And when we came back, we'd go to the bank manager and say, let's try and get a loan. Hmm. So we had a fledgling mail order business. And you go into the bank and say, hey, I've got this great game. It's a role-playing game, which you're a hero and or a wizard, and you kill monsters, you find treasure. And he looks at you rather like a dog watching television. And she's kind of to leave quite quickly, but that didn't deter us. So we had to rent a van. I mean, Steve had a van, which lived in that van for 3 months.
Wow.
So we could afford at least to have a little office to carry on the mail order business. And we eventually opened a first retail shop in Hammersmith in 1978.
Yeah.
And then we could actually afford somewhere to live.
And you had a property. So was there any times then when you were, between the flat and then that office where you were just like, what are we doing this for, guys? We're living out of a van. Like, this could have all crumbled then.
Yeah, but you're living the dream. And, even though it was probably awful because it was winter and it was raining, it's stinky. And
two guys together.
And we joined we parked next to a squash club and joined the squash club for a shave, a shower, et cetera, and got really good at squash by default. And then out of the squash club into the mail order. So this little triangular life. But it was just fantastic because we were kind of making it up as we went along, and we realized that people were really enjoying setting up Dungeons & Dragons clubs. And then we had more shops, and the whole thing grew. And then Alan Weasel became White Dwarf magazine. Then we started Sisters of Miniatures, so people could have their miniatures of paint up to represent their figures in the game. So happy days.
Yeah, I can remember when I first got first kind of thing with figures was Hero Quest. Remember that? It was a Milton Bradley game, I think, which was obviously riffing on some of the more complicated.
What was involved with Hero Quest and Advanced Hero Quest.
Yeah. So they were like the simplified versions for people like me who was like 10 at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, but even that's quite, I mean, that's, I think that's like late 80s Hero Quest stuff like that. It's,
yeah.
But before that, of course,
Warhammer came about.
Yes.
And the reason Warhammer came about is that we'd only had this 3-year exclusive distribution agreement with Gary, at the end of which he said, let's merge the two companies together, TSR and Games Workshop. And Steve and I, being independent Brits, said no. So we lost the exclusivity on D&D, and that had to be replaced. So Brian Ansell, who's the MD of Citadel Miniatures, and Richard Halliwell and Rick Priestley came up with the basic Warhammer concept and wrote the rules, and that became the mainstay of Workshop over time.
Yeah, I say, which has lasted to this day. I mean, we'll talk about longevity in other areas soon, but like, I mean, when you're making games, because you've made your share of games as well. I mean,
I've designed quite a few.
Yeah,
I'm a games designer by trade, really.
I mean, do you know when something's going to have those kind of legs, or do you know when you're making something for a big audience, or whether you're looking at it going, well, this is really only appealing to me, and if it's only appealing to me, then that's potentially problematic.
I think now, after 40 years in games, I have an idea, pretty reasonable, good gut feeling how a game's going to go, but you never know the kind of scale it can achieve. Like with Tomb Raider, we had no idea that it was going to get as big as it was, and we had no idea when Warhammer started how big it would get. We absolutely had zero idea how big Fighting Fantasy would become.
Mm. Yeah, which are all now just... I mean, I don't think it's too grand a word to say there are kind of iconic franchises, series within the mediums that they're in. But you sold Games Workshop, right?
91.
I mean, was that, given that was your baby? I mean, was that a hard decision to take? You just said like you'd refused a merger,
Well, it was, we'd done 17 years at Workshop. It was our baby. Brian Ansell, who was MD of Citadel and had created Warhammer, he was taking more control because Steve and I were also at that time writing Fighting Fantasy game books. So you can't run a growing business like Workshop and come home to our respective homes and write fantasy novels till 2 o'clock in the morning for any long period of time. So Brian took more and more control of workshop. We became less involved in the day-to-day running of the business. And it just seemed a logical sense that we agreed to a buyout, basically. I'd also become very enamored by the growing video games industry. Mm-hmm. I'd written the design for the launch product of Domok back in 1984. Death Trap Dungeon, one of the Fighting Fantasy game books I'd written, was number one in the charts. And this startup came to me and said, would you design this game, which was Eureka? And so I invested in that company at the time and eventually joined Domok after sending out a workshop, and Domok metamorphosed into Eidos.
Yeah. So let's pick up on that then, because, I mean, Eidos was the publisher behind Tomb Raider, which we sort of mentioned then. But when you, just before we started recording, you were just recounting an awesome tale about how Tomb Raider came into your, you know, you got involved in it. So why don't we pick it up there? Because you were looking at this other studio's properties that it had, basically, the games it was working on.
Well, we floated Eidos in 1995, a small flotation, and needed to grow quickly, get some scale into the business. And the only other company listed was Centergold. And they were suffering some cash problems. They had a pretty torrid time during the demise of the 16-bit era. Mm-hmm. Had lots of inventory they couldn't get sold. And their investors kind of got tired of the whole process. So it was an opportunity for Eidos to acquire Centergold. And I was tasked with doing the due diligence. For those who don't know what that is, it means you have to go around and look at all their assets and see what they are that they say they are. And mine was to look at all the studios and the content. So I went first to Silicon Dreams. It was March 96. It was snowing hard. And I had kind of debated whether or not to cross over the Pennines to go to Derby to go and visit Core Design. Mm-hmm. That was one of the studios owned by Centergold. But I did. And I was greeted by Jeremy Heath-Smith, the MD of Core, who took me around the studio, showed me all the games in development. And in the very last room, the door opened and there was this female adventuress on the screen. And I guess, you know, cliched, but it was love at first sight, because here was a figure in a game that I'd never seen before. A, female. Secondly, a 3D character moving in a 3D world into the screen, as opposed to the traditional side-scrolling games that was around that time. And it had fantastic technology, fantastic graphics. You could have, it wasn't just moving in, there was actually height in the terrain. And it's kind of like all the stars were aligned. So I got very enthusiastic about what was turned out to be Tomb Raider and Lara Croft. And we acquired Centergold. And 6 months later, we launched it. And I think we had 100,000 units in the budget, and over time sold 7 million copies of Tomb Raider 1.
It's not a bad underestimate, is it? That's
it was all good.
That's pretty crazy. I mean, what do you think hooked people that hard then? Because like you say, it wasn't the type of game that we were really seeing before. I mean, I can remember that like the future is now transition to kind of rest its soul, the Saturn, and obviously the PlayStation, the behemoth that came. I mean, Tomb Raider came out first on Saturn, of course, which was apparently didn't have the 3D technology necessary to make it work all that well, but I guess you had it running
running fine. But you know, PlayStation were pretty keen to get a bit of a monopoly going on some of the premier titles, because software sells hardware. So Wipeout and Tomb Raider became some of the lead franchises that sold the PlayStation, because they managed to get an exclusive on those titles. And it was pretty exciting times.
Looking back, it's easy to look back, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing. But I mean, when you see how that game was playing, can you see it as a very much a kind of prototype for kind of these, the 3D quote unquote action adventures that we play today? I mean, it's very easy to see how a series like Uncharted riffs on Tomb Raider, but not even just because of the plots and the places that he goes to, but just the way it plays. I mean, it did so much for,
well, some of the
3D gaming
on Uncharted were also worked at Crystal.
Oh, were they?
Before.
Oh, wow.
So clearly it was an influence or inspired by. But it was all really down to the small team of six people at Core Design. I mean, they achieved something monumental. Yeah. the vision of Toby Gard, the creator of Lara Croft. I mean, he'd been tasked to create a new character to replace Rick Dangerous, which was a PC game.
I remember it had it on the Amiga as well.
Yeah. And everyone thought he was going to come up with another male character. But he's argued that, you know, with the rise of girl power, Nana Cherry, Tank Girl, why not have a strong, independent, intelligent, athletic female lead character, especially one that's going to be a 3D character moving into a 3D world. And supported by the, you know, the brilliance of the engine that was created, the level editor, which is easy to create lots of environments that were just easy to traverse. Mm. And these three pillar components of Tomb Raider, which was, you know, puzzle solving, exploration, and combat. It was just bound to be a success, but no one knew how long and how big Tomb Raider would be. But as we see now, she's survived the test of time the same way as James Bond has in film.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and has moved into film. I mean, with more films to come, I think there's new Lara coming,
yes,
isn't it?
So I'm told. Yeah. I was involved with the first two.
You were personally involved with the first two.
Yeah, we went over to California and we picked Paramount and had fun times negotiating with Larry Gordon Associates, who were the producers.
Right.
And we had, Jeremy Heath Smith had a executive producer role, which gave us as a team the veto over the cast and over the script. And when Larry Gordon's team said we'd like Angelina Jolie to play the role of Lara Croft, we said that's absolutely fine with us, no problem whatsoever.
We'll go with that. But have you got any ideas for the butler? Well, there's this guy in Red Dwarf, maybe you should look at him. That's always thought that was some odd casting. That must be his biggest role in America, Chris Barry.
But at least it was a good film, you know. It wasn't a lot of games characters had been treated pretty badly by Hollywood, but it was enjoyment. It was definitely mass market entertainment.
Yeah, I didn't quite find that. There are some, like you say, some tragic examples. Poor old Street Fighter never really recovered from the touch of Jean-Claude, did it? But it's funny. I mean, you know, you say about Lara lasting the test of time, and I think it's reasonable to say I was playing it again last night. Like Rise of the Tomb Raider, which is the latest one, of course. I mean, it was one of my favorite games last year when it came out as an exclusive on Xbox. And now on PS4, I'm playing it again. And it's just such a terrific game. And it is, I mean, do you get the chance to play all of the new Laras when they come out, all the new Tomb Raiders?
I do, but I don't play as many console games as probably people think I do. Because I play a
lot. What time? You're a busy man.
Time is busy. I am a busy person with lots of different companies I advise and help, but I'm also a big board games player as well. I got over 1,000 board games at home. Let's get that out there right now. You know, I'm happily admit to it, and I play a lot of mobile games, but to commit a long period of time to console gaming is pretty tough these days, even though it's, you know, very enjoyable experience and sort of interactive, beautifully graphic intense experience like a Hollywood film. You know, I usually only have time to snack on mobile devices these days. But Tomb Raider, it was a huge success. The only bad bit I can remember is when we had to move the development from Core Design to Crystal Dynamics.
Right.
Core had executed brilliantly 5 iterations of Tomb Raider on PlayStation 1, but being tasked to move over to PlayStation 2 was perhaps a bridge too far.
Right.
They were pretty exhausted by delivering every year a new title. Every year having to execute and come up with some brilliant new ideas, new adventures. And there's a bit of a bottleneck in tech, and net result was Angel of Darkness was not the game it should have been. And the camera was a bit out, the control was off.
And that was probably the first time, as I remember it, that Tomb Raider took a little bit of a
dive.
Bit of a critical dip. And you know, players like kind of, they weren't revolted by it. They still bought it. But,
and also, she was running around Prague and Paris rather than running through tombs. So the fans were a bit, disappointed.
Lovely city, so they are. But yeah, I mean, you know.
But, like James, not every James Bond film's been great. But,
absolutely.
The fan base still forgave her. And look where we are today. Crystal making amazing games.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. We had a couple of podcasts ago, I had a guy on, and we were talking about, favorite games of this year, and he was just banging the drum for Rise so much. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those. I mean, it's funny, like, because she was, it's hard for maybe younger listeners to appreciate this, but 97, 98 sort of time, Lara was genuinely everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, when a video game character is advertising drinks on TV, that broken out of the medium, hasn't it? I mean, she's. Yeah. I mean, we had Mario do, you know, well, Nintendo are very, very, you know, they like to keep hold of their properties, I know, but we'll see. We had the, you know, Mario Brothers hit cinemas, and yeah. It was that idea of reaching out to medium. But I think Lara was probably the first breakthrough star, I suppose, from the medium into other places.
Well, she went
say?
Beyond the games industry and graced the covers of Lifestyle magazine, not just games magazines. First virtual character ever to be on the cover of Face.
Yeah.
And as you say, she was used to promote other people's products. So some big tickets were using Lara Croft. And that was great for Eidos for two reasons. One, they were paying the company money to use Lara Croft. And yeah. B, were promoting Lara Croft as much as they were their own products. So
yeah.
It was a win-win-win.
Yeah. I mean, how do you think that, you know, having seen her as she was that very first time you walked into court to how she is now, do you think the development of Lara has been good? I mean, I think, you know, as a, like you say, still this very strong, independently willed female role model in video games, you know, I think the new Lara is great. You know, the kind of take no nonsense.
Yeah,
and,
she's become
and
a very
determined.
Believable character, a lot more.
Do you think she's a bit more comic booky earlier on?
Yeah, it was. And also, it was in the 90s. You know, there was a lot more lad magazines out there. So people didn't question everything about a character before it was put out there. But the games industry's growing up the same way as other early industries, and a lot more responsible for its content. And you know, Lara Croft has become a pillar of society almost. But I still remember the iconic Laras of old. You know, the cover of the very first Tomb Raider is perhaps for me the most memorable one.
Yeah. Did you see the way that they packaged the Rise of the Tomb Raider for this 20th anniversary one, where it's in a little PS1 case?
No, I haven't seen
that. Have you not seen that? I don't know how wide. I think it was reported and stuff. I've got one at home, so it looks like, you know, it's the old kind of that same size cases. But it's funny, you mentioned mobile gaming. Because Lara Croft Go was great. Did you ever have a bash at that?
I saw it was very successful, as was Hitman Go.
Yeah.
And well done them getting to digital. eventually.
Well, Hitman's been a bit of a quiet success of this year as well. I mean, it's see how it goes. I mean, that's an old Eidos thing, isn't it?
Yeah. It was released, I think, in 2000.
Yeah.
First.
So in terms of what you did at Eidos, which I know is, you know, not, are you life president of that company now, technically?
I was life president of Eidos.
Yeah.
But Eidos is a brand now.
Yeah.
And so when Square Enix acquired Eidos, I thought it really has to be only a matter of time where I kind of cut ties. And, you know, did it with Workshop, now I've done it with Eidos. So I've let go of that title. It's not for life.
But what, I mean, you know, Tomb Raider aside, I mean, what were your kind of favorite projects that you oversaw in that role then when you were at Eidos?
Well, I was involved mainly in content because I'm the games guy. I love original IP. You know, coming up with new franchises and ideas and hope they resonate with an audience is what really gives me a lot of satisfaction, from Final Fantasy to the Workshop stuff and to Eidos. So working with the developers at Eidos was really exciting. Coming up with ideas myself, you know, I came up with the idea to do a Who Wants to Be a Millionaire game, Pony Friends, had a lot of influence in all their major titles, signed Lego Star Wars.
Just a small deal, without, you know, just a small thing.
Because they'd been turned down by most of the publishers.
I bet, yeah.
And I thought it was
Lego,
fantastic.
Lego can't work as a video game.
Yeah, hello, Lego and Star Wars, quite well-known brands, possibly could work
together.
It's
madness now, isn't it, when you think about it, but...
Yeah,
that's crazy. And in terms of the developments you've seen, obviously that move from what was the 16-bit era to PlayStation, that was quite a big sea change. But I mean, what other things have you seen? I'm wondering if you've, like, you know, if you look at what VR's doing now as substantial steps forward for the medium and how we play and how we interact, whether it feels a bit kind of gimmicky to you. I don't know. I'm interested to know your thoughts on that kind of side of things. Because Lara has kind of grown up with every hardware generation, you know, looking better, producing... Arguably, these last two are my favorite Tomb Raider games, I think, of all time.
What's interesting and fascinating about the games industry is that technology evolves the medium like no other entertainment medium, you know, film and music, TV, don't transform the way games do. You know, 10 years ago, Facebook wasn't around and suddenly it becomes a huge platform for social games. Then along comes smartphones. And that gives another extraordinary opportunity because a lot of people are intimidated by a 16-button controller. So rather than admitting they're no good at games, you just say they don't like games. But suddenly Apple comes along with swipe technology and anyone can become a gamer. Plus, access to the App Store made it very easy, one-stop shop for your gaming content, all you can eat.
Yeah.
And free-to-play makes the delivery and choice infinite.
Are you a kind of pro free-to-play, or do you think it's some... I don't know. Exploitative is the wrong word, but it had a bit of a bad rep for a while, didn't it?
Well, it's free at the point of delivery.
Yeah. Free to after that, access.
That's true.
Yeah.
But only 2% or at the most 5% of people spend money inside free-to-play games. 95% act as the viral spread. It's those, I think the ones who spend are either impatient or have got an ego problem. They, you know, pay to win in many ways. But yeah, I like the medium. I like mobile games. You know, yeah. I'm involved in quite a few, several of which are free to play. So I'm still put my finger in everybody else's pie. Sumo, that's the only console games company I'm involved with at the moment.
In Sheffield.
In Sheffield, right, yeah. And they developed Little Big Planet.
Yeah. Did Snake Pass at the moment?
Snake Pass,
yeah.
New IP that's coming out next year. They're working on Dead Island 2, also doing Crackdown. So these are, you know, big old titles.
Yeah.
And Sheffield is quite an unknown but brilliant force for games creativity.
Yeah, I wouldn't immediately leap to it. Well, is Team 17 around that part of the world as well? In Yorkshire?
They're slightly north of that. And then you've got quite a few studios in around Nottingham, and of course Games Workshop's in Nottingham. Mm. So, yeah, East Midlands. Creative force for games.
It is. It's funny. I mean, I guess we automatically gravitate towards obviously Japan being a powerhouse of games production and America to some extent. But is the UK sometimes guilty of not celebrating our own a little bit? I mean,
well, this is one of my hobby horses. I try and get government connected to games as much as possible and try and put a positive spin about games in the media because we are very good at creating games. Everyone having access to the BBC Micro in the 80s and the Sinclair Spectrum got kids programming then. Plus, we're naturally creative. Look at our film, fashion, music, architecture, publishing. Of course, our games industry. You know, put creativity with high technology. Hey, presto, video games. So we got off to a flying start. You know, Matthew Smith and then, you know, Populous and Elite and all those early triumphs. Matthew Smith, Manny Miner, and then Tomb Raider came along and we're punching well above our weight.
Oh, and you mentioned Wipeout. That was a British game, wasn't it? Psygnosis, yeah.
And at the last count, there's over 1,000 game studios in the UK. Most of them are micro studios. But some of the biggest franchises in gaming history have come out from the UK, you know, from Football Manager, Grand Theft Auto 5, of course, the largest entertainment medium in any industry. It generated $1 billion of revenue in 3 days. Hello.
We're
very good.
Someone with your experience and your kind of, you know, all the kind of roles you've been through, you must have looked at that GTA 5 launch and just gone, wow, this is, you know.
Well, that's exactly the sort of thing we should be celebrating as a nation. The economic, cultural and social impact of Grand Theft Auto 5 is enormous. And yet a lot of the popular press tends to talk negatively around some of our great success stories in games. And games have always been seen as trivial, and I think they should be used a lot more in as a learning tool, because if you can part your prejudice against one or two titles and think cognitively what's happening when you're playing a game, problem solving, you cannot get through a game without problem solving. You're learning intuitively. You can fail in a safer environment. You're encouraged to try again and not punished for making mistakes. And creativity abounds. You know, Minecraft, children learn so much through playing Minecraft. They can build these wonderful 3D architectural worlds, share them with their friends. And, you know, who wouldn't want to become an architect after playing Minecraft? And you can add context. Like Railroad Tycoon, for example, you take control of building a theme park, the staffing, the rides, adjusting the prices, and you do it right, the customers come in. If you don't, they don't. And you tweak the parameters. So that's kind of a cross-curricular learning experience which simulates a real world. That gives massive learnings to children to play a game. But play is always seen as trivial.
Yeah.
It's not It doesn't seem to have any rigor about it. But why can't learning be fun?
Yeah, it's funny when you kind of, you know, mentioned then about how certain sections of the press still want to see the negative sides to gaming. Is that partly because of the language we use? Like, say we play, we game, and these things are kind of seen as not serious. You can't shake them off because that's what they are. They're video games.
You can't measure it, and you can't measure the contribution. But when we arrive in this world, we interact with it, and we learn as babies through play.
Yeah.
That's a natural learning way. And as we get older, we enjoy solving puzzles, and we attach rules to puzzles that become games, and we interact through games, and play is natural. And I don't think you're ever too young to start or ever too old to stop.
No, well I hope not. I mean, you know, you still play. What do you think about, like, things, I mean, not necessarily kind of esportsy games online, but I mean, one of my favorite games of this year has been Overcooked, and you can play with your friends and share the experience. Mm. And of course, you would have been working on games, a lot of games that you played locally with people. I mean, do you think broadband, just the speed of broadband that we have nowadays, has been a massive factor for kind of acceptability, I suppose, of games, being able to link up with your friends, and video games almost becoming social tools as much as learning tools, as much as entertainment. You know, what are you doing tonight? I'm hanging out with my friends on FIFA or Rocket League or, you know, Minecraft. Minecraft is practically a social media platform for kids, you know, and adults, but, you know, mainly kids. Yeah,
it's great, and it's going to get better. I hope I'm going to be around to see the time when we can actually be with our friends virtually in another world, and actually be living Dungeons and Dragons rather than just thinking about it.
Of living Dungeons and Dragons. Whenever I think of, like, you know, the people, do you remember the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon in the
1980s?
Yeah. Well, I liked it at the time.
Well, it wasn't shocking. It was shocking for someone of my age played serious D&D, but as a child, it must have been amazing.
It looked wonderful, but it never finished. I always think about those kids being stuck in that fantasy realm.
Are they still there?
They never finished the series. So yeah, presumably they're stuck in this strange limbo. But the thing that upset me about that as a child of the 80s was that we all know who Optimus Prime is. Nice, heroic Transformer. And the same voice actor did the nasty wizard in Dungeons and Dragons. And I couldn't...
That must have been terrible
for you. In my head,
it
was practically the same voice when you listen to it now. It's very upsetting. But I digress. Business hat on. I wanted to ask you, because we've had a bit of a turbulent 2016. If the UK does what it thinks it's going to do and leave the EU, what impact could that have? Oh, we suddenly turned serious. On some of those studios we talked about that need celebrating, because I mean, I know for a fact that, I mean, I've spoken to other developers and I know people in the studios, and they're like, well, you know, we use talent from the mainland to come here and help us make these amazing things.
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel that the UK games industry is kind of playing a bit of a waiting game here to see what goes on, or are people kind of taking measures against the B word, the Brexit?
Well, games industry, along with most creative industries, were very much pro Remain for various reasons, not just the cultural fit and being part of Europe from a business point of view. We need unrestricted access to the single market and unrestricted access to EU talent. Now, since June 23rd, I've heard lots of cases where those people living in the EU who'd been offered jobs in UK studios have since decided not to come because they don't want to feel that A, they're not wanted, or B, might be told to leave or go to all the hassle of bringing their families over without certainty.
Mm.
It's the uncertainty that's a big problem. And access in the single market, if we don't have unrestricted flow of goods and services, that again could be a problem for game studios. What's going to happen to the digital single market? What's going to happen to free flow of data? Mm. I mean, there's lots of things people probably haven't even thought about that could be problematic. On the plus side, you could say, hey, those are being paid in dollars. They're suddenly doing okay because the pound has dropped so much. So short term, some games companies will be doing very well. Thank you very much. But I don't think it's anything that people wanted or still want to happen. But we're being told to make the best of it. So the best of it we will try and do.
Yeah. I mean, I hope that it doesn't, you know, dent the productivity in this country too much. Because like you say, I mean, you know, I mentioned it then, you know, I'll use it as an example. Overcooked, a game I've enjoyed very much, published by Team 17. I'm not trying to plug it or anything, but made by two people. And those are the kind of breakthrough things you must have seen over the years. Where like you're saying, that first Tomb Raider to be effectively made by six people, that's mind-blowing. really, isn't it? Like,
but it's getting harder to do that. These are the exceptions rather than the rules today. You know, that if you just look at the App Store, for every Angry Birds, there's 10,000 dead birds out there. There's a lot of games that don't generate any revenue. And unless you're featured or you've got a huge budget to do user acquisition, you're just going to wither on the vine and no one will know you even exist. Mm. So there are challenges for people on mobile platforms and probably on Steam as well. Every platform is getting pretty jammed with content. Yeah. So I wish them all well.
I mean, do you get the opportunity in your, you know, when you go and meet people to kind of advise and sort of say like how to stand out in that marketplace? And like you say, I mean, clones, you're always going to get them, unfortunately, trying to ride on the coattails of someone else's success. But you must see games that have promise and just sort of think, if you just wait on that for 6 months to a year, let it bubble, let it simmer, and then release or then look to do something, you know, because you don't want to, like you say, it's so jam-packed. We just saw, I mean, a big game, Titanfall 2 came out, EA game, that just died commercially, relatively speaking, because it was sandwiched between these other big games.
Well, in console, the big franchise is just getting bigger. The ante is being upped in terms of production values. More and more is being spent because it has to be spent because the processor powers of the machines are getting bigger. So you have to deliver on that potential. Then you have to complement that with an equally larger marketing budget.
Yeah.
And everyone wants to play the same titles. So it's no surprise the FIFAs, the Call of Duties, the GTAs, the Tomb Raiders.
Well, Call of Duty sales were down this year. I mean, it's all relative, of course. We're selling six figures in a week. But
yeah.
I mean, is that the franchise fatigue that's been squeezed? Yeah.
The ones that aren't AAA by brand or production values that are just kind of falling off the edge of the cliff because people have got so much choice elsewhere, whether it is Steam, whether it's mobile. What about VR? What about AR? You know, the Pokemon phenomenon.
Yeah.
There's a lot of choice out there for people.
Yeah. I mean, I struggle with it all the time when I get home and I think, I need to play something, but there's... Yeah.
Time is a commodity we're all short of.
Yeah.
Like I said, that's why I can't play as many console games as I used to do. But I still play my board games, still the same games group.
So why...
Running since 1986.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, you know, families and whatnot. I mean, so you still have the regular kind of meetups with them and...
Yep, it's same people. Steve Jackson.
Mm-hmm. Some people will know who he is. I've definitely heard of that man.
Clive Robert, who owned a company called DR Studios.
Right.
And two non-gaming guys, Sky and Mark. But we have a cup. And I'm the secretary of the Games Nightclub. I've published 432 newsletters to a circulation of six. It's a spoof gentleman's club. There's a long waiting list. Media have tried to come and film us. We've never allowed it. And we keep a point score after every game. And at the end of the year, the first with the most points wins the cup.
Receives a trophy. That's awesome. And I mean, so what have you been your... Because we cover... board games. We were streaming some when we launched Waypoint. What have you been your big hits of late then that you've loved playing? You know, from just a this is so much fun, and also from a game designer hat on, just thinking the way this works is incredible.
We've enjoyed playing Splendor, a very nice card game. We still enjoy playing some of the classics like Ticket to Ride, and Small World, and Kalos. Anything where you can do deals and immediately renege on them. So try games where luck is still a factor, but it's a minor contributor. It's more about deals, negotiations, strategies, and being able to become the smiling assassin.
So seeing the longer game.
As you stab your friend in the back and take all their goods.
My wife and I, we've started to dabble a little bit. We haven't got many yet, but we just got pandemic like last Christmas, and
there's been a huge revival in board games as well. Yeah. I think obviously thanks to Kickstarter, people.
It's funny you should say that. Well, I was just at Indiecade in Paris last week, and Luke Crane, who's one of the main games people at Kickstarter, was doing a keynote, and he was saying, I haven't got all the stats are written in my notepad at my desk, but he was saying like one of the most funded strands on Kickstarter is board games now, way more than video games, and particularly RPG board games, more than anything else. Like their success rate is something like 76%, which is unheard of for Kickstarter. I mean, I don't know. Do you have a theory why that is? I mean, are we just enjoying boom times for RPGs?
Well, the distribution channel for board games is non-existent. There's not many game shops in the UK. So how do you find, how do you reach your audience? And you can with Kickstarter. A, it's the market telling you whether your idea is any good or not. You get the funding and you distribute straight to the consumer.
Yeah.
So you're bypassing all the traditional distribution channels and you've effectively pre-selling your content rather than making 5,000 copies of a game and they all end up in staying in your garage.
Yeah.
You've pre-sold them.
Yeah. And I mean, we'll move on to Fighting Fantasy because I really, really want to. But well, you told me just then, like, it's 35 years next year.
Next year, yeah.
See, that's exactly the kind of brand, though, on a Kickstarter tip that I could kind of see, like, here's the revived Fighting Fantasy.
Yeah.
And being through that kind of model, saying, like, do you want this? Or is that something that ever crosses your mind when you look at these funding methods?
I've had a few approaches about Kickstarter, and I've had 21... models made of the iconic characters from Fighting Fantasy.
Right, okay.
They are resin models, come in several parts, and at some point we will reach out to the Kickstarter community to launch them, whether or not it comes with its own game system or adapted Fighting Fantasy game system or a board game, don't know yet, but the models are done and they look amazing. So all the shape changes, Blood Beast, Zambar Bone, Yastromo the Wizard, all the, you know, the best bits of Fighter Fantasy.
Yeah. I used to have that Out of the Pit book. I used to read, so some delights from that, no doubt.
There's some of those in there, definitely.
Well, for anyone who doesn't know what Fighting Fantasy is, I know we've said the brand a few times, but just quickly summarize, I suppose, what they are.
Fighting Fantasy game books are effectively branching narrative with a game system attached. They look like normal novels, but there's a huge amount of difference. They're broken up into 400 paragraphs, numbered. At the end of each, there's a choice whether to turn left or right, simplistically, fight a monster, collect an item, or get, and your days in a very sort of gruesome way.
There's a large pit and you've fallen into it. Yeah. See you bye. Yeah.
There's hundreds of ways of going through a Final Fantasy game, but only one correct way. So it's effectively like analog hypertext. So you jump from page to page. And the difference was that normally children, they didn't used to like a passive reading experience as much as an interactive one. And suddenly they were given the power. They took control of a Fighting Fantasy book. They were the hero and they made the choices. So it was all about them. And they could go through it time and time again and get a different outcome.
They talk about their
own adventures, who the monsters they killed, the treasures they found. So it was a very personal experience.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a copy of one of them here. So this is City of Thieves I've got in my hand. Not that anyone at home can see it. One of my old books. This came out, there's only 5 available.
Yeah, I think.
Glory times. But yeah, I mean, you've capitalized 3 times on the back here, you. So it's all about...
It's all about you.
The reader, the player, the hero. And these books, for me, I think I must have first got one... I was around about 8, maybe. Yeah. About 8 years old. And like you say, I just devoured them after that. Because I enjoyed reading anyway, but suddenly there was these things that tapped into, I was aware of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings and some of that fantasy stuff. But suddenly I was like, here were stories that were in that vague ballpark area that I kind of controlled.
And we tried to give people really perilous decisions to make. And obviously it's set in a world of monsters and magic. And so you thought this world existed. You know, wizards would be casting spells, dragons would be breathing fire at you, and the treasure was there to be had. But painful, painful decisions. I used to love writing bits to kind of lure readers down to their doom.
But that's all right because they had their finger on the last page.
Cheating.
Right? Yep.
That's okay. It's everyone all right. Cheats. Honestly, it's like peeking around the corner. I used to see people on public transport everywhere with what I called the 5-fingered bookmark. That used to make me laugh.
I bet if they came back, that's exactly what you would see. I mean, it's like having different, like you say, if it was hypertext link, you'd just open them in different windows or different tabs, so you didn't meet your demise. But I mean, it's got Penguin on the back of it. I mean, Penguin was the company you went to for it. I mean, so Warlock of Firetop Man was the first book.
The first one. But it wasn't easy getting published.
Yeah.
We'd been running these events called Games Day in central London, which was Dungeon Dragons Days effectively. And Penguin Books came along and had a stand at one of the Games Days. And the editor, Geraldine Cook, was kind of bemused and overwhelmed by the enthusiasm that role-playing gamers showed at Games Day, you know, sort of kind of totally immersed in the characters that they were role-playing. And she said to Steve and I, would we be prepared to write a book about the phenomenon of role-playing? And we countered by saying, well, rather than writing a book about the hobby, why can't we write a book that is an experience of the hobby? And she said, oh, that sounds great. And we'd said it, we didn't really know what we meant.
No, you have to do it, yeah.
We thought we could create something, and we came up with this concept called The Magic Quest, with a synopsis of this interactive book. And Geraldine took it to her managing director, who laughed at the proposition, saying that could never possibly sell. Yeah. Who'd want to read an interactive book with a game system attached, rolling dice?
Yeah, right. So you have to, you know, check all that your record stamina,
keeping.
Yeah,
my God, that just sounds dreadful. So it took them a year to make up their mind, and they eventually commissioned us, and Magic Quest became Warlock of Firetop Mountain, which Steve and I wrote together. I wrote the first half up to the river. And
Who wrote The Maze?
That's Steve. He always tried to complicate things. He still does. I'm sure he won't mind me saying this right now. But
that maze, I tried playing it a year or two ago again, like properly. No cheating. No, I just got stuck. I got stuck in the maze. I looked up and I realized I've been at it for about 6 hours.
Yeah. But Penguin still didn't really believe in them because they looked like a normal book. The salespeople didn't know what they were really, but they just appeared in the shops. And Steve and I kind of thought, well, it's not doing very well. I didn't hear anything from them when it was launched in 82. So we mentioned it in White Dwarf magazine to kind of promote it ourselves. And we suddenly heard that a few schools had got hold of them, and it kind of spread through the playground, and that spread to another playground.
Huge school.
Word
for me,
of
mouth,
the most powerful viral promotion you could possibly have, became and kind of almost like an epidemic. Yeah. And suddenly everybody wanted to play the Warlock of Firetop Mountain, and it sold out. And Penguin did like 11 reprints in a month because they still couldn't get their heads around the fact that it might have a phenomenon on their hands. And suddenly the editor came on the phone and said, perhaps we might need two more. So Steve wrote Citadel of Chaos and I wrote Forest of Doom. But there was so much negativity in the media about them because there was no way of communicating through the internet about what was going on.
Right.
The playground chat remained on the playground.
Meanwhile, hold of British playgrounds.
The media was saying terrible things about them. The Evangelical Alliance published an 8-page warning guide about them, saying if you're interacting with ghouls and demons, clearly you're going to get possessed by the devil. Mm. A woman in deepest suburbia, having phoned in her local radio station, said that her son, having read one of my books, levitated. So the kids are thinking, for £1.50, I can fly, and we'll have some of that. And then there was a magazine article saying the danger of interactive play. Children are using their imaginations. God forbid they should ever do that.
Imagine that. And then how many millions later?
Like, there was petitions.
Fine, you know, crazy.
Yeah, and well, long story short, they sold 18 million copies in 30-odd languages. They were phenomenon. And they increased literacy by 17% because it empowered the readers. But the establishment at first would really struggle with fighting fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, I like you say, being in a school at that time, that they became something that we swapped, that we collected. It was something that, like, when it was coming out to Christmas holidays, you'd be like, which one are you going to get? Okay, I'll get that one. And so you get different numbers. Because, of course, for a while, when I was really, because this predates me really, really getting into them, I would have got this secondhand. It's got someone else's name on the front, you see. So D. Butler owned this before I did.
Okay, I'll sign it to D. Butler then.
You sign it to D. Butler later on if you want, yeah. But they had the green spine and the numbers on them. Yeah. So, you know, on your shelf, that's what you wanted. If you had missing numbers, that was a bad thing. Yeah. So
you think it was a good idea to number them?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, the collector inside you, even as a kid, were like, well, I'm missing 18, 21.
Because there's a very strong possibility that they're going to be republished next year because of the 35th anniversary. And do you keep the same numbering system? No numbering system?
I think it has to be the same numbering system, even though I know that ones much later on correspond to ones before it and stuff.
And I'm toying with a new one. And where would you put that one in the series?
Well, so this new one you're toying with, I mean, you told me prior to coming on here that City of Thieves is your favorite, or one of your favorites, one that you've written.
Yeah.
So if there's a new one, you're thinking about maybe sequeling this?
Well, it wouldn't be a direct sequel, but it'll be quite a few visits to to Port Blacksand and some of the characters from City of Thieves.
Yeah.
Would definitely.
What is it about there. This particular one with this lovely skeletal man with a deadly sword?
That was actually, that illustration was done by Ian McKay, he's a legend, if anyone is.
It's beautiful.
He did four of my covers. He did City of Thieves, Death Trap Dungeon, Forest of Doom, and Island of the Lizard King.
Island of the Lizard King.
And you can see the resemblance.
Number seven.
There. Well done. Here's Zambar Bone on the front there. Yeah. Ian went on to work for George Lucas and created Darth Maul.
Oh, really?
And if you think about it, Zambar Bone on the cover of that with the spiked cranium has a slight resemblance to
I'm picking up Darth the vibes. Maul. The illustrations are something that maybe go overlooked until you look back at the books. Some of them are so vivid and detailed.
Did the internals on that one as well. So
Look at the motion. I mean, is it possible on a podcast to really convey this? But here we've got what type of creature is that there that we're looking at? Well, he's a little imp kind of goblin dude.
Yes.
But he's clearly playing a game. He's going to pitch the ball.
That was a terrible pun. It was a bay and they were playing baseball.
There you go. But there's so much life captured in that little picture.
Well,
it's
everything
great.
That Ian did had movement and drama. I mean, the cover of Forest of Doom with the shape changer rising off the log with the spines breaking through his clothing. That was another argument we had with Puffin at the time, because they were a children's imprint. They wanted to have covers that were very safe for their parents of the children. So they wanted
a
nice toadstool with little gnomes sitting on the toadstools and butterflies circling the gnome. And we wanted covers that threatened to rip the faces off the readers. And we won that battle.
As much as a piece of paper ever could, Nasty paper cuts.
So we managed to convince them to use Games Workshop artists and the artists we knew at the time.
Yeah. I mean, they are, I'm so glad I dug them out and they were at my parents' house for years and years and then they were chucking stuff out. I was like, would you want these? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to keep them. I've got a five-year-old and a three-year-old myself and I suspect we'll probably dip into them. They like monsters and dragon, witches, warlocks, etc. I mean, this stuff is timeless. It really is, right?
It is, because it gives power to the reader. They imagine themselves in the shoes. That's not somebody else's character they may not relate to. It's all about them.
Yeah.
And it works wonderfully. And collectively, Steve and I used to go to schools and conferences and created an audio adventure. And they'd be like, 300 or 400 kids in a room and we have the sound effects and describe the scene that they're in. And like, there are four statues in the room and one is black and hideous and worms coming out of its eye sockets. There's gas seeping out this chest and the other things are fine. And what do you want to do? And they say, open the chest with all the steam and the maggots coming out of the guy. And we'll say, if you do that, you're going to die instantly. Open the chest. And they always want to explore the kind of bad option rather than the
good
option.
It goes back to, it's the safe space to, it's another safe space to kind of do crazy, things you would never do in real life. Maybe we'll get a chance to read a few little bits of that. But I wanted to run through some questions as well. Because we actually, quite a few people sent me some questions to ask you. I'll pick out a few. But I think I mentioned it earlier on to you, but a guy who works at a website called PC Games N, Jeremy Pill, asked, how do you feel about seeing what was Games Workshop's kind of core business, those kind of RPGs and stuff, bleed into video games? And I guess you trace it back to you bringing Dungeons & Dragons in, establishing Warhammer, and just seeing now how like some of the biggest video games out there, The Witcher, Final Fantasy series, etc., are just riffing on so much of that stuff. I mean, is it a pride you feel?
Pride and immense pleasure when Final Fantasy in particular, because we wrote every single word of the book you mentioned there, City of Thieves. If people say they were influenced by it or inspired them or made them want to be in the creative industries or an artist or a writer or a games designer, that is just very, very rewarding. And to hear it from grown-ups, many years on since they read them it's a very humbling experience and I just can't get enough of hearing these stories. Yeah. It's brilliant. And to know that some of our early work has had an influence on the games industry is also doesn't get better than that.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess, I mean, naming their names, but sometimes, you know, you meet people who have been in business, I mean, you know, music as well, any other industries, and, you know, they kind of fade away from it a little bit. It seems to me, because we've spoken before on the phone for a previous interview, that you're just as passionate now about what games can be and what games can do as you've ever been.
I just love the mechanics of games. I love the joy it brings of sort of people coming together and enjoying through this medium of play a really good time. And, you know, I'll never stop playing games. Why would I?
Yeah, yeah. I need to rattle that into my dad's head, I think. I think growing up in my house, it was very much like video games were like, you know, the treat, the special treat, not something you should just do. But they were kind of frowned upon a little bit. It's funny, I think it's better now. Like, I would encourage my boys to play a bit more.
It's but, okay, folks. Play is fine.
Yeah, you won't levitate if you, well, unless you really want to, maybe. What have we got here? I know that the answer to this is yes, but James Parrish asks if you were reading other people's adventure books, did you cheat read your way through those?
I never read anybody else's books ever.
No? None, because there was a lot one. Of... you wouldn't say rivals, but other people picked up upon the format.
Yeah, Final Fantasy was first.
Yeah.
Lone Wolf was second. That
yes,
was written by
which I'd never heard of until
Joe
today.
Joe Deaver somewhere. And Gary Chalk, who used to work for Set Games Workshop.
Right. Because that was quite big, apparently. I genuinely never heard of it till this morning. Yeah.
And Joe and Gary were writing, was going to be an interactive book series for Workshop, but they decided to go solo. So, yeah, good luck to them.
Yeah. I read about it. They sold fairly well.
Yeah, they did really well. It was the number two series, I guess.
Yeah, number two.
Well, second in time.
Yeah, and, absolutely. I mean, and in terms of your own books, I mean, there were very few that I ever played properly.
Yeah.
There was, especially when I got to some of the later ones where I just, you know, just consuming them quickly. Like things like, I'm trying to remember what they call it. There was a Keep of the Lich Lord, I think, maybe. And
yeah.
Black Vein Prophecy, was that quite like in the 40s or something? I remember having them, but I don't think I ever played them properly. Should I go back and play them properly? Clearly I should.
You need to buy them all 59
all
of them.
All 59.
Collect them in your nice numbered series on your best bookshelf and at number one again and go through.
I think I've got up to maybe 51. There was a Warlock sequel, wasn't there? There was another Warlock.
Return to Firetop Mountain, that was number 50.
That was 50, I think I've got.
And it was going to stop the series then, Puffin said, all right, we'll just round it off with number 50, which I wrote myself. Yeah. And they thought, hang on, they're still selling. So they lurched on for another nine games.
Sorry,
books.
Ian, you can't stop. It's tying you to your desk. Yeah.
Well, we couldn't actually keep up with the demand. Yeah. And some of the later titles were, we had other authors contributing to writing them for us. But
that, I mean, that makes total sense. But I mean, after a while, even I saw it as a kid, it was very much a case of like, this was yours and Steve's brand as much as it was your, so you were kind of curating
it's our regards.
Army, yeah.
It's our world But we allowed guest authors in just because Puffin said, we need more, more, and we just couldn't keep up.
And presumably you were vetting these things anyway.
Yes,
you weren't
of course.
Just like, it wasn't. So they were coming through you, not through Puffin. Like these authors you were
saying. Well, they were being commissioned through by Puffin, but we were obviously involved in the selection process.
Yeah. I mean, I always used to love the shiny kind of shield, you know, the glossy, your names on it. Just a seal of approval, wasn't it? No offense to Steve whatsoever, but the early books, I remember trying to play Starship Traveler, and I found it really hard.
I told you, he did the maze.
I always did find your ones. That's slightly
but
more.
Steve also wrote
more relatable
some epics. I mean, the Sorcery epic was quite an achievement.
I know people who love Sorcery to pieces, and of course, that's had a great. Did Inkle do the adaptation?
Yeah,
I think
he had an incredible success with Inkle. Did an incredible job on iOS and Android.
Yeah, and there was you know, there was a fighting fantasy adaptation quite recently, I think. I can't remember what it was now. I'm kind of going off script a little bit, but I'm sure
there's
I saw
a Warlock of Ito Mountain on Steam from Tin Man Games, who do all the fighting fantasy apps.
Yeah.
So Inkle do the Sorcery, Tin Man do the fighting fantasy.
Amazing. Final thing. Here it goes back to Tomb Raider, actually. Matthew Cooper asks if the next Tomb Raider should maybe shake up the formula a little bit. I don't know what he means by that, but you know, I mean, we've seen the reboot and Rise. They're very much in the same vein. I mean, should Tomb Raider kind of stick to its guns, or do you think that it could be, I don't know, something else?
Well, I don't think anyone wants to see Lara Croft in space, do they? So I think you have to stick to the formula.
That's the jumping the shark moment, isn't it? The cliche. That's Moonraker. Like you said, not all James Bonds were good, and Moonraker was not good.
I think people have a certain expectation of what Lara Croft should be doing in a game. Yeah. And
raiding tombs, ideally.
Yeah, as long as you stick with the three pillars, and exploration, puzzle solving, and combat in that environment that she's so well known for, I think I don't think you're going to see much to deviation. Not that it's my decision, no, not choice, but that, yeah. If I was still there, I would not be voting for her to move much beyond her normal realms.
Yeah, and do you think she's got another 20 years ahead of her? I mean, is she going to be like a Mario that's just going to be around as long as games are?
I'd like to think so. If it's 20, why not 40?
Completely agree. I mean, I don't. I think if the quality is there of the game, you know, you make a few bad games, then that's problematic, and that's how series disappear for the most part. Speaking of which, someone does ask, Steve Hask, who's a great writer, friend of mine. I'll phrase it as he phrases it. What was the thinking behind Angel of Darkness, brackets, but not that you likely had all that much direct involvement, close brackets? I think that we already said that's the one where it kind of dipped a little bit. So
yeah,
that
was the first Tomb Raider on PlayStation 2. Mm. And it was technically challenging for core design and led ultimately to the franchise being moved to Crystal Dynamics in California for the reasons I gave before.
Yeah.
Bad control, bad camera, and wrong environments, and not being able to deal with PlayStation 2 development in the way others had.
Yeah. Just too much, too quickly, maybe. Yeah.
Yep. Didn't scale the team in the right places at the right time, unfortunately. But let's not ever take away what an amazing job Core had done to get Lara to that point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they were a fantastic, they were a powerhouse of the 90s. I mean, I remember other games they produced as well. Thunderhawk on the Mega CD. Great game.
Yeah.
Loved that one. One more question I'll ask is, James Gray asks, and you might have dreamt this, he says, but did you really take up yacht racing in the 90s?
I did.
I dropped that in there. I haven't looked it up. So yacht racing, Ian.
Well, it was a thing called an Ultra 30, and it was the game. It was the first, in its first year. This boat was called Games Workshop. It was actually called Warhammer.
And it that's was a good 10, name for a boat, though, isn't it?
It was a 10-meter, effectively a dinghy. It would go 25 knots downwind. It was terrifying speed, and you didn't actually sit in the boat. You hiked outside of it, and I had a guy called Laurie Smith helming it, who was a veteran Olympic medalist, and also he'd done the round-the-world race 3 times and skippered the boat. So he was a veteran skipper, and I enjoy sailing as a hobby, and it was an opportunity to get into racing. So I did for a bit.
Here you
I
go.
Don't know, clearly.
Well, I mean, you know, there's, and that at a time when, you know, you were so busy as well still. So, you know, fitting it in.
Yeah, well, it was only kind of, you know, weekends now and then. I had somebody look after it and, you know, organise it. It was actually a televised series that went around Britain. It was a bit odd, but.
There you go. So there you go, James. You really did take up your racing. Well done. I was going to find, off the top of your head, can you remember a chapter that's going to end in death?
I can't remember the numbers, no.
I'm going to try and find
it. All you got to do would look at the last sentence as your adventure
is
over.
Yeah, this is the thing. I was trying to find if something's bold or not. But it would be amazing, as an if and when there's another one, that you could come back on and see us, and we could talk about a new book, hopefully. Or whatever happens next in Fighting Fantasy, because I'd love to. The little fanboy in me was like, Ian Livingstone, he's going to read some of this book. It'd be amazing.
Well, I'd happily read it out. But
big intro on City of Thieves.
Well, I like to set the scene.
Yeah,
and
long
do
background.
A lot of character development and also make people feel that they're not alone. So in Death Trap Dungeon, for example, you met Throm the Barbarian, who became your friend and aide through the dungeon. But then I kind of poleaxed the reader by having them have to battle poor old Throm to death. Because it could only be one person go through Death Trap Dungeon allowed to come out alive. So
I remember the cover.
Used to create a few moral dilemmas for people.
I used to be freaked out by the cover of Death Trap Dungeon. Had
with
a
the
weird
blood beast.
Yeah.
With the
horrific.
Multiple
horrific.
Eyes on the front.
Okay, here we go. I'll leave listeners with this. So however you got to 56, would you like to tell you read 56 for me? This would be beautiful.
You're
going to
make the
moment.
Choice, are you?
No. There's no choice at the end. So.
There are over 20 guards coming to get you, and it is useless to put up a fight. They drag you off to a room at the bottom of the tower and chain you to a wall. To your horror, you see the two trolls enter the room. They take it in turns to beat you before passing a sentence of 5 years solitary confinement in a dungeon cell. A few minutes later, a hunchback jailer arrives carrying a bullhide whip. He fixes a ball and chain to your leg before leading you downstairs to begin your jail sentence. You have failed in your mission. So that, folks, is the result of making the wrong choice.
That's the wrong choice. And you know, hearing that now, I can understand why the press was terrified of these things. Imagine a little five-year-old now going, "Mummy, what's a bullwhip?" Well, that's awesome. Thank you very much, Ian. Where can people find you to follow you on the socials and stuff? Where can they find you? Because you're a Twitter user.
Twitter, yes. Yeah. At Ian_Livingstone.
Fantastic. And please follow Waypoint at Waypoint. We are Vice's new gaming channel and we're having a lovely time. Thank you very much again, Ian, for coming
pleasure.
In and joining me.
Great talking to you about games.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Life is a game.
Life is a game. And listeners, see you next time. Bye.